If you're a fan of the Resilient Recruiter podcast, I've got exciting news. I'm hosting a special event for recruitment business owners in London on September 17th and 18th, and I'd love you to join us. If you want to achieve your full potential, you need to surround yourself with the right people. At the Recruitment Coach Live Summit, you'll get to meet some of my podcast guests in person, hang out with us, and share ideas. Some of the folks I've interviewed on the show will either be attending or speaking at the summit. Early bird pricing is still available. Register now by visiting recruitmentcoach.com/summit. Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby. Today, I'm joined by Jessica Hamilton.
People think that you need to reinvent the wheel, but I do the same stuff now that I used to do when I first started in recruitment. Like I BD every day. I do marketing every day.
Jessica's name is synonymous with financial crime recruitment. She is the thought leader and industry expert in her space.
I really wanted to be seen as an expert, not a recruiter. I really leaned into that consultant side of recruiting. I don't want to be just to see as someone who can find you talent. I became someone who advised on how you should structure your financial crime teams because this is what your peer bank is doing.
She's been recruiting in financial crime for just over 10 years. Initially with Robert Walters, and then with another large global recruiting firm, Investigo, where she built from scratch the biggest billing financial services desk globally.
So I didn't know anything. When I say I knew nothing, I didn't know what a bank was. I didn't know what a derivative or an equity or a fintech or anything was.
After the birth of her first son, Jess and her business partner Ian Christie launched their own business in 2022 called Fink Select.
Work is work. It is so far down my priority list if you're looking at my life. And I've created that priority list because it's my life and it's my responsibility as a business owner to decide what's important.
Jess, thank you for being here.
My pleasure. It's really nice to be here.
Yeah, great to meet you as well. So I believe you're from New Zealand, correct?
I am. There's a little actual New Zealand map there that someone might spot.
I see that. Awesome. So you won't know this, but my mother-in-law is a Kiwi. Oh. And so my wife has dual citizenship. I've never been yet. We'd love to go over,
in New Zealand, your wife? Or
no, she is Scottish, but her mom grew up in New Zealand and then immigrated over to the UK.
Very cool.
This is a completely non-business related question, but I think you're from the North Island and you went to university in a city called Hamilton and your last name is Hamilton. Is that just a random coincidence?
You know, and any New Zealanders listening will know this, Hamilton's not the most glamorous of towns. And I've got four brothers who mock me relentlessly.
Oh, okay. Hamilton's a really common name here. But so is that your married name then?
That's my married name. So I was Hodson before and I got married a few years ago, yeah.
Wow. So I guess that was an icebreaker when you first met your husband. Oh, your name's Hamilton?
Yeah. That's how I wooed him.
There you go. All right. So tell me the story of how did you get into recruitment?
I've always kind of done sales types of roles. Actually, since I was really young, I used to work in a phone shop. And then in New Zealand, I worked for a company called LeasePlan, which they do lease cars. And then I moved to the UK and I was applying for jobs. LeasePlan had got me a marketing job. So I was in marketing for LeasePlan. And I applied for a marketing job through Robert Walters and they saw my CV and called and said, do you want to do recruitment? And I said, I just want a job. So I tried it out and I loved it from the get-go, really, really loved it. But I started doing marketing recruitment for law firms and property firms. So it was a really easy, I knew the product kind of thing. It was really fun.
Okay, fantastic. And then you initially recruiting marketing roles, which makes sense because that was your background. How did you get into financial crime? Because actually, I need to tell you, you're the first person I've met who specializes in financial crime. As soon as I read your bio, it makes sense that there would be recruiters who specialize in that. But how did that come about?
It is honestly the most London story. I was in a pub.
Okay.
And I met
lots of good stories start in a pub.
Exactly. And I met a girl and we got chatting and I said, you know, recruiter, what do you do? And she said, I do financial crime. And I was like, what is that? And we just spent the whole night talking about it. I was like, this sounds amazing. And I timed it really well, to be honest, because there was a lot of regulatory pressure. It was a bit of serendipitous kind of timing. there's a lot of regulatory pressure happening in London at that time. And so Robert Walters had always done regulatory compliance and financial crime, just like you were saying, kind of as a combined desk. And I went to the director at the time and said, I think I would really like to do this desk as a separate. And he said, okay, you've got about 6 months. And off I went.
Okay. So two questions then. First of all, I have an idea just from the movies of what financial crime is, right? Like white collar crime and, you know, all this kind of stuff. But could you elaborate? What is it? And then what was it about that appealed to you?
And I can tell you what it is. So in the banks, like if you were looking at a retail bank, these teams help capture the fraud. They set the policies to make sure no money laundering is going through, no one who's sanctioned. So you're talking about, you know, the bad guys, bad actors. And the bigger corporate banks, it's much more sophisticated than sort of wholesale banking. So it's essentially ensuring that no money laundering is done through the banks or the financial services provider that we're working with. But also they've got to adhere to a lot of sort of laws and regulations like the sanctions. You remember the Russian sanctions regime that came through? That was a huge impact on our sector. So that's what they kind of do.
Just so I understand, it's sort of a subset of the regulatory aspect of
it's like compliance
services.
Right, so you know how like a compliance team in any organization, these guys are the specialized team that do that side of things. And the reason I got so interested in it is there were so many avenues to it. So we've got financial crime, we've got sanctions, we've got anti-bribery and corruption, and then all of those have policy or advisory or program or strategy. So it's just so layered, and every year that I've recruited it, inclusive of this year, the roles change. So you are recruiting the same roles over and over again, but the focus, because of the regulatory landscape, changes. So this year, for example, we're doing lots and lots of data and tech and AI recruitment and financial crime, whereas 5 years ago, that was completely, I'd never even touched it. So it's just, it keeps the gray matter going a bit.
Yeah, I bet. I guess the good thing is that every financial institution will be required to have these men and women on their team, right? So
yes,
they have to hire, right?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, so are your clients banks or are they consultancies? Like what?
Both.
Who is your?
So we our sweet spot at Think Select is we do a lot of the mid-tier banks, and then we do most of the fintechs and some consultancies. So
okay.
For example, if a consultancy is going in to go and work for a bank to do a big remediation project, they may come out to us to help source them that talent to help them do it. But we work directly with the banks as well.
Okay.
Quite a lot.
All right. Awesome. So let's talk about how you built your – I want to spend most of the time talking about Think Select.
Yes.
But I am interested in how you built the biggest billing desk in financial services at Investigo. Mm. Why do you think you did so well there?
It's not in the Kiwi nature to boast. So I'm going to try to do this as best I can.
Go for it. You have my blessing.
I think just talking broadly about why someone's successful on a desk is tenacity. So I have been doing fincrime recruitment for so long through all the peaks and troughs where people come and go in and out of it. So I think my market is a lot deeper and broader. So when people come to me, they come to me. But at that time, I was really one of the first people in my company and from what I could see in my discipline working across LinkedIn. So I used to post all day, every day. I'd partner with other recruiters and create videos together about like the state of the financial crime market. It was a really like, it's my pleasure to know other recruiters in my space. I think it's a really nice thing to do for me because I can steal their knowledge. but it's more like I really wanted to be seen as an expert, not a recruiter. I really leaned into that consultant side of recruiting. I don't want to be just to see as someone who can find you talent. I became someone who advised on how you should structure your financial crime teams because this is what your peer bank is doing. So that would be maybe a differentiation from what I could see.
Yes. Okay. So I'm glad you mentioned that because I want to drill down on that because I know that branding, marketing, and you know, positioning yourself as a true expert and consultant rather than just a CV Slinger has been kind of one of the cornerstones of your success. Before we dive into that, you mentioned tenacity. Could you give an example of a situation or a time when that really was important?
Yeah, it was in the best example I can give is in that first 6 months. So I had gone from being one of the top billers in the marketing team, but you know, my first couple of years, I was one of the top, first top biller then. And then when I moved to set up this desk, I didn't bill for 6 months because I knew nothing. I had to spend the whole time meeting people. And it was just this engine in me that I just knew it would be good. I knew I could do it and I knew what I needed to do. And it's the same stuff, like people think that you need to reinvent the wheel, but I do the same stuff now that I used to do when I first started in recruitment. Like I BD every day. I do marketing every day. I have a thing where I have to be curious. So I don't know why more people don't do it, but I ring my hiring managers or I ring someone. You know how I talk about the data and analytics side that's coming through. I ring them and I say, look, I don't know anything about this. Can we go for a coffee and can you tell me about it? And people love it. They love that you've got an interest in it. So I think it's the tenacity and the curiosity and that real self-belief is really important to me because no one else is going to do it for you.
Absolutely. Okay, this is brilliant. So you told the story initially where you wanted to change to financial crimes from marketing and your boss said, okay, you've got 6 months.
Yeah.
And so the clock is ticking, right? You have to make something happen, at least so they can see there's a viable, a business here. And so you're super enthusiastic and keen. You don't know anything, but you're curious, you're interested. So you dive in month one, month two. It takes time. Like it's going to take at least 6 months to start a new desk, right? And longer if you don't have the experience and the market knowledge. But then month four, month five starts rolling around. That you must have been feeling some pressure. Like, how did you stay true to that vision of what you wanted to do when you weren't placing anyone yet?
So, actually, I've never actually explained it this way. I used to think of it as a university project because I was so not too far away from being in university in those days. And so I didn't know anything. When I say I knew nothing, I didn't know what a bank was. I didn't know what a derivative or an equity or a fintech or anything was. So that was the other learning curve that I was doing alongside FinCrime. And I just kind of set myself little milestones personally that I wanted to do. Like I wanted to host an event with all the heads of financial crime, and that was going to come in month five. So I needed to get out and meet all those people and get the invites out. So having side hustles, the wrong kind of word for it, but side projects that contribute to a broader vision keeps you focused because it can become really monotonous, very sloggy. You don't feel like you're seeing the small wins. You know, if you're constantly calling people and they're not answering your callback, it's not going to, you need a small win that keeps you going alongside, I think.
Great. Okay, that makes sense. I love that answer. Going for small wins rather than just focusing on I need to make placements.
Yeah.
You know, it's breaking that down into projects or small wins. So
I've always and still think placements are symptomatic of a system you've got behind it. Placements, my old boss used to make fun of me because I care about placements. Of course I do. But I almost lose interest after the second stage. Like they're done. They're going to make money. I need to go and fill the funnel back up, or I need to go and do something else. That's just a management piece at that point. So if you keep your eye on placements also, you forget that the placement is the prize. It's not the program.
Can you repeat that? The placement is the prize, not the program? Yeah. There's a lot of alliteration there. I think you might have just coined a phrase.
Maybe. You see it on a t-shirt one.
But could you explain that a little more?
What I mean is that like, most salespeople I know can tell you about their numbers and most salespeople can tell you about their pipeline. But when they talk to you about their pipeline, they talk about the other end of it or their funnel. They talk about what wins are coming through. I don't think it's relevant at all, but I think that if you're constantly filling it up, and by filling it up, I'm not just talking about interviews. I'm talking about marketing, BD, meetings, establishing yourself as an expert, doing panels, doing podcasts, doing all sorts of other really cool stuff, your funnel is way further back than people realize, the program, and then it filters through. So if you're focused over here and all your time and energy is going here, well, then we see it all the time with sort of, you know, the juniorish billers where the inconsistency comes through.
Yes. Okay, great. Let's talk about that top of funnel marketing and BD effort then, since that's something that is your forte. You're obviously really good at it. And so, in fact, let me just refer to my notes here. You talk about the art of the soft sell. Can you say a little more about that?
I think.
You have a lot of great phrases, by the way, Jess.
Lay awake at night. Thank you. So I truly believe people don't like to know they're being sold to. And the best analogy I can give is when you go into a clothes shop and people are all over you, it's really annoying. But if you're walking around the other day, they're like, oh my God, I just bought that top. It's so cool with a pair of jeans. You're like, oh, is it? It becomes like a credibility issue. So the soft sell comes from, for me, and it needs to lean into your personality style, right? And I'm not saying the hard sell doesn't work, because I've worked with some really like punchy recruiters and they're super successful. But for me and Fink Select, we're very relationship led. Even our temp side of the business, which is hugely successful, isn't like a temp desk. It's really relationship led. So most of our work comes through referrals. Most of it comes inbound off LinkedIn or people approaching us. And that comes because we're credibility led versus recruitment led. So you'll see me posting all the time on LinkedIn about like how to recruit. I did this week. How do you recruit a search for you on LinkedIn if you're in financial crime? And I showed them the screenshots.
I saw that. That post absolutely blew up. Yeah, over 300 engagements. How many impressions did that get?
That got about 40,000 impressions in a couple of days, which is, you know, and that's what I mean is all of those people have now seen, oh, Jess cares about her candidates. She really understands that this is a pain point for them. And it's a genuine, authentic thing because there's so many people out of work. We've got a lot of redundancies at the moment in London. Or I'll post, today I posted about some financial crime internships that are going with clients of ours, Apply Direct. We do post our jobs and we do post obviously relevant stuff, but you can't just rely on that, I don't think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I love this. So talk to me more about becoming a thought leader in your industry and becoming known as like the go-to person. You committed very early on to posting on LinkedIn. That's something we teach our coaching clients. But it sounds like you've been doing that for years.
It's a game changer. It is a game changer. The amount of people who know me because of LinkedIn and don't necessarily know me is phenomenal. Like I went to a networking event or I was speaking on a panel a few weeks ago. And so many people were coming up going, you're from LinkedIn.
LinkedIn. Right.
What more could a business owner or a salesperson want? People coming to you to introduce themselves to say, hey, I've seen you on LinkedIn. You know, there's a fine line as well, I think, between LinkedIn and posting and impressions and how you kind of do it. Some people lean into the videos, which I think is really cool. I just don't have the confidence to do it yet. Or the tech, it just really needs to be whatever you do online needs to really resonate with you as a person, because when people see you, I'm really casual and quite giggly as a person and my posts reflect that. I write like I talk. You must write like you talk on LinkedIn, because otherwise people, one, it goes back to they don't like to be told that they've been sold to. So if you are writing like, I've got a great new product, people scroll past, they have no interest. But if it resonates with them, like I was talking with a client the other day, people go, and they read. So there is an art form to the medium that you're posting on. And you've got to have some respect for the fact that it's LinkedIn and not Facebook. And it's also not a business journal.
Yes. Okay. So write like you talk. There's one golden nugget straight away that people should be taking note of, because that is absolutely fantastic advice. And by the way, we can help you with the video side of things. Starting with this podcast, we're going to break this up into little reels, little short clips. We'll give you all that in case you want to.
It'll be my first foray and, you know, maybe it'll be the start of something.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay. So posting content on LinkedIn consistent. How often are you doing that, by the way?
All the experts say every day. I stick to three times a week because it's There's no excuse then. Sometimes, like every day, I'm with clients and or I'm busy or I'm working on a shortlist or something. Three times a week, you can find time. And actually, the best times that I've found for me posting is a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, and between 10 and 4 gets the best engagement. I saw a tip the other day, and someone else is going to have to verify this, but apparently, if you comment half an hour on someone else's post before you post yours, your engagement goes to the top of the feed.
That's true.
It is true. Okay, because I saw it.
Well, to the extent that LinkedIn don't reveal the algorithm how it works, but a lot of people have studied it and analyzed, like done a lot of number crunching to figure out, you know, these things. And it's true that if you comment on someone else's post, then when you post, they're going to see your post. So you can be a bit strategic.
I think it makes sense from a LinkedIn perspective, right? Because they want people who are engaged and commenting. So they want to encourage that behavior. So, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. Yeah, okay, brilliant. So three times a week is definitely realistic to do consistently. I think that is the key, is consistency. It's like going to the gym, right? If you aim to work out every day, that's, for many people, that's not obtainable. But if you think, I'm going to work out three times a week, and I'm going to absolutely commit to that, and nothing's going to stop me from achieving that, that sounds like a great mindset.
But also, like, start slow. Like, I'm not saying, like, my team have made fun of me, because it's one of those things that comes naturally to me, and I appreciate that it doesn't come naturally to some people. So I can pop out a post in an hour because I've been doing it for ages. Copy and paste news articles and write a little bit of commentary on them. Make sure you post a job ad, because people obviously want to see job ads from recruiters. But don't post a really vanilla job ad. It's a real missed opportunity, I think, for people to showcase their depth of knowledge with their clients and the job they're recruiting. So I always write something about the hiring manager, something about the company, and I don't write stuff about the company they can find on the FT. Like, I don't write, oh, they've got 300 million AUM. I write, like, you know, the team has gone through a bit of growth. There's a huge investment in the financial crime teams. They're building a new system. Something that shows that, hey, I know them and I know them a lot and I know what's going to suit them. It's another marketing opportunity. It's a soft marketing credibility opportunity.
I love that. So by the way, for our listeners or viewers, if you're watching the video, definitely go and check out Jessica Hamilton's LinkedIn. Content. She's doing a phenomenal job. Just while we're talking about being creative with your job post, another person to check out is a client of ours, Gordon Rennie, R-E-N-N-I-E, who recruits in the offshore, or sorry, the marine industry. Ooh. And his job posts are hilarious. He basically tells stories and somehow links a personal story with what he's actually recruiting for. And he gets he fills a lot of jobs from just these humorous LinkedIn. Now that works for him, because he's quite funny himself. Yeah. I couldn't pull that off in the same way, but I think it's finding your own way of posting jobs that isn't the vanilla post that you're talking about.
And like the job posts obviously have a two-sprung effect, right? So your clients can see the job and everyone can see the types of jobs that you're working. You can see the attraction, you can attract candidates and things. The pushback I've had once or twice from new clients are, how do you search for the jobs? And I say, I post them on LinkedIn. And they said, oh, well, why would we pay for that? And I'm like, I have got a refined and honed captive audience on there of financial crime professionals. You're not paying me to post a job ad. You're paying for 10 years of connections.
Yeah.
And our placement rate off the job post is about 80%. It's usually people I already know and they're just going, hey, send me a WhatsApp and say, I've saw the job. Can you think? And it does the job for me. And it's not that I'm lazy in any regard. I still LinkedIn search for and ask for referrals for every job, because it's one of my pillars of when I search. I just want to make sure I don't get complacent. But it really does. It pays off if you can just start personalizing your job ads. And I know some people here listening will be working for a corporate and you've got a fixed job template that you need to do, and you can post the picture. Before you do it, if you think you're going to have pushback, just chat to your boss and say, I just want to try something different for a month. Let me see if I can post some emojis with it, you know? And see what happens.
Definitely. I'm all for that. One thing I would respectfully disagree on, Jess, is resharing articles. And I had this conversation with a potential client yesterday, because that's what he was doing and he wasn't getting much traction. And that the reason for that is that, so that's called curated content versus original content, right? Mm. Sharing other people's stuff. I'm not saying never do that.
Yes.
But the LinkedIn algorithm does not reward that. So it's just not going to give you the organic reach as something that you yourself have written, especially if you link to an article that's off of LinkedIn, because LinkedIn they want you to stay on the platform, right?
So, no way. That's so interesting. You know, that's a really good tip. I didn't know that.
Yeah, pleasure. Absolutely. So LinkedIn is only part of it, though, because you've talked about panels, you've talked about conferences, you've talked about hosting events. Can you say more about, from a marketing and branding point of view, the kinds of things that have worked well for you?
Yeah, panels. And we are now, so we sometimes get asked to speak on panels for free. Ian, my business partner, is phenomenal at FinCrime Operations. Like, he is I call him the king of KYC.
Okay, cool.
He gets asked to speak a lot about that, and I get a lot asked to speak about the more senior and sort of permanent hires. But we also pay. So this year we have been really intentional with our marketing budget where we will pay to sponsor an event, and we have a rule: we only sponsor it if we can be the only recruiting sponsor, because we don't want to dilute our credibility. I think when you're signing up to sponsor a panel or you're doing anything like that, it's credibility by association is really important. And so if they've got us and four other agencies, it just looks like we've all kind of chucked money at it and hope for the best. Whereas if we're a sole sponsor, it looks like they've picked us as their sole sponsor and agree with who we are. And to be honest, the places that we're sponsoring wouldn't do that unless they believed in us and think that we're great. So we sponsor panels. We also are really invested in making sure our money is where our mouth is, and we sponsor things that are really important to us. So we sponsor a Young Financial Crime Professional Network. So they do like speaking events and drinks quarterly, and young financial crime professionals go to that. It's really in line with our values of making sure, we can talk about it later, but we really want to stop pay gaps. And, you know, so with social mobility is really important to us. We think networks are crucial. But from a marketing point of view, oh, where are you going tonight? Oh, I'm going to the Think Select Young Financial Crime Professionals event. Oh, what's that? Like, very authentic, credible marketing. And then, of course, there's the LinkedIn posting that comes from things like that. And we're speaking at that event alongside some really heavy hitters in the industry. So and it works. We got two jobs off the last one we did. So it's great.
Okay, this is really interesting. So let's separate those out a little bit. So the panel, speaking on a panel.
Yes.
How have you sort of researched, identified, targeted, and then approached the event organizers in order to decide what is going to be the best return on effort for you guys?
I reverse market it. I go and ask people I love and I want to get work with, what events are you attending this year? And then I go, okay, I run up and go sponsor them. So there's certain ones that I know are really good, like the ICA, which is the qualification here, or there's certain consultancies that we really know have a really strong foothold and clients we want to go into. So we work with them on sponsoring. And people, you know, people are really receptive to it. If they've not even had a sponsor, we approach them and say, we would really like to sponsor this. How do we go about it? We would like to co-brand with you. Like, we're talking at the moment with a really, it's not done yet, so probably shouldn't talk about it, but it's a really credible thing, and we're going to be the sole recruitment sponsor. And if we get that, they send a monthly mail out to the global heads of all the firms we work with that are like, it's just, and they're going to do a LinkedIn webinar series with us where I'm the industry expert talking. Like, it's just phenomenal. It's a really cool
brilliant option. Yeah, I love this. That's so smart, Jess. How do you, so I guess there's panels where you might get invited as an expert and you're not sponsoring the panel, but you are just speaking on that. So how do you decide between like whether you're going to sponsor the event or you're just going to speak at the event?
Oh, I can get away. I was not sponsoring it. I will.
Okay. All right.
Basically bribe them to have me on the panel. So we get asked, so if they already want a recruitment specialist, 9 times out of 10, they'll come to us. over our competitors because of all the credibility work that we do elsewhere, which is like you can pay for that kind of privilege. If they haven't got a recruiting specialist and I know that people I want to be around are going to be there, or I've seen the panelists and I see that it's people that I think have really influence, it's that credibility by association. So if I'm sitting on the same platform as the head of financial crime for HSBC, you bet people notice.
Totally. That is genius, Jess. So how do you decide if it's a more established and larger event, they're going to have sponsorship packages, right? Mm. But if they haven't got that, how do you decide how much is a realistic budget for that?
Yeah. So it all comes to ROI, doesn't it? It's not scientific. I think, what do I want out of this? And it's really hard to get the ROI out of branding, positioning, and all that kind of stuff. It's really hard to tangible. But if I think, okay, do I think I can get one job out of this? And then I think, okay, I can probably, if I can get one job out of this, I will offer them this. And usually when they've not got speaking packages, we don't want to take the mickey out of them either. And you know, we want to make sure it's fair and rewarding to them. And sometimes we do things like we will co-advertise the event for them as well.
Right. Exactly. They're actually benefiting from your network and reach as well, right? Because you're going to be promoting the event. Hey, we're sponsoring or we're speaking at this event.
Totally.
So they're actually getting, you know, the benefit of your advertising as well.
Yeah, that's right. Like it's not to say that we are a superstar or anything like that, but people know us. And when we post that we're going to an event, people notice. And likewise, I notice when other really great recruiters are going to events as well.
Love that. Okay, fantastic. Anything else that you guys are doing from a marketing branding point of view to really, because I don't want to get too technical with the marketing lingo here, but you have top of funnel, middle funnel, bottom of funnel, right? Yeah. And there's a kind of, if people can imagine an inverse pyramid, right? And you're spending a lot of intellectual effort figuring out how can we really build that top of funnel so that we're creating this awareness, we're building an audience, we're building a brand, like recognition and reputation. Mm. Which is then going to precede, because then if you're making business development calls, it's so much easier because people have already heard of you. It really is going to increase your response rate to like cold outreach.
Absolutely.
It's going to increase the receptivity of people when you phone call them.
Yeah.
Are there any other things that you are doing in that regard?
So, you nailed it. So like LinkedIn messaging is, I love a phone call. I think phone call is king. Always. Well, video call if you can. I love surprising people on a video call sometimes. Not as a BD call. People already know. I just video call. But LinkedIn messaging as well. We are really consistent with our LinkedIn messaging and the metrics on it and how often people reply back to us. And I know everyone sends LinkedIn messages, but I absolutely, from a marketing perspective, thinks it is absolutely bananas that people send long spiels in their first message. Hi, I'm Jess. Yes. I'm from Think Select, and I'm no one cares. I just messaged them, and I just, hi, it's Jess. I wondered if you have time for a coffee next week. That's it. I don't tell them why. I don't tell them how. I don't tell them if I'm trying to hire them. Are they, you know, do I think? And then they say, may I ask it's what it's about. And then I go into something really specific. I'll quickly go into ChatGPT about the company or, you know, find out something. And I'll just say, look, I saw that you guys had done this. I was really interested. How did that impact what you're doing? Or I'll mention a common connection. Oh, you know, I saw that you worked with John from Dada. How have you found the transition to your new firm? Like, no one ever wants to hear about you as much as you do.
Right. Good point.
And I think that the focus on, for me, on marketing should always, and sales, is tell people what they need to know, not what you want them to know.
Okay. Can you repeat that? Tell people what
they want to know, what you want them to know. Because so often we assume people need a lot of information from us, but people want headlines and they want, like, what do you want, essentially?
Yes.
Yeah.
I love this just because the ambiguity of, you know, can we meet for a coffee next week is they don't know if you're recruiting them or if you want to partner with them and help them recruit for their team. And so they'll read into it whatever makes sense for them.
Whatever's in there going on in their little lives at the moment. And I love it. And I've met so many connections. And the worst thing that can happen, okay, the worst thing that can happen is they don't reply. Well, it's not, I don't really care. But, or you meet them for a coffee and nothing comes of it. But then you've got a connection. And there's nothing more beautiful than meeting for someone for a coffee and having nothing going on that moment and then contacting them a month later after you've already met them and they've got a job going.
Right. Absolutely. So you're really planting a lot of seeds here.
I what's that saying? I create a larger surface of luck for when jobs come in.
Say that again. You're creating
a larger surface for luck.
Larger surface for luck. Okay.
Yeah. So I try and meet as many people as possible and or connect with as many people as possible. I'm sure everyone listening to this knows that the more touch points you have with someone, the more likely you're going to get a job from them or a placement from them. So I try and do a lot of that. And it leads into the curiosity that I have. Like, I never go on assuming I know what someone's job is. I always say to people, tell me about what you do day to day. And then they tell you. But I don't say, oh, you're in financial crime advisory. It's not a chance for me to showcase that I know everything about their job. I can do that when they're talking about their job. Tell me about what you do day to day. And they tell me about what they're. Oh, so are you doing front office or back office advisory? You know, you can show your credibility with questioning. You don't need to lead with your credibility, I think.
I get it. Absolutely. So are these coffee meetings in person or are they virtual?
Either. I prefer face-to-face, truthfully. Yeah. But virtual, I sometimes have to talk to myself and say, no, virtual's fine because I'll end up booking up like two very meaty days in the office and it gets a bit whirlwindy. Whereas I could do a few on Teams, but Teams, I think, you know, there's no downside to doing a Teams versus a phone call.
Yeah, great. Absolutely. Like to me, in-person is
king. Yeah.
And then secondary to that would be what we're doing today, which is it's virtual. It's not as good as like being able to shake your hand and see you in 3D.
Yeah.
But it's better than a call where you only have voice to go on and I can't see your body language.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I agree 100% on that. So I want to back up a second because you mentioned something I've never considered before, which is video calling people. Of course, we do that with our friends and family, but you do that with clients and candidates?
I treat clients and candidates like family. Like honestly, how I talk to my family is how I talk to my clients and candidates. So it's not strange for them to be like, texting me about something and I'm just like, can I call? And then and then I just video call them. It's like, what are you talking about?
So you're FaceTiming people.
All the time. No, WhatsApp. Great. So I have WhatsApp desktop.
Oh, WhatsApp? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that's my go-to. I saw a recruiter podcast not too long ago and it was a guy saying that he BD video calls and we did some BD training a little while ago with the team and the guy, we had an outside consultant and he said, send video messages as the BD. I don't know. Like I've not tried it. I couldn't speak on it, but it's just not my style. And I think you always push yourself, but lean into your personal style and what people expect of you. But video call, so good when you're talking to candidates. The more FaceTime you can get with a candidate in a process, the better. So if you've only met them once when you review their CV or you sit down with them before you submit them, or even at the second stage, that's good. If you want to close them at the end, you best believe you've got to have a couple of video calls between. They're going to become your best friend.
Yeah, definitely. And so, by the way, we love video messaging for prospecting or recruiting for that matter. So we've got clients who do it for business development and for recruiting. But so with WhatsApp then, when you first engage with a client or a candidate, at what point are you adding them to WhatsApp?
As soon as humanly possible. Like I could tattoo it onto myself. Like, so I try and teach the team, if you're calling someone, and nowadays clients give you their mobile numbers, not their landlines, right? So you've got their mobile number. I sometimes, if I'm a bit sneaky, is I will message them and say, hey, it's Jess. I tried to call you. I get them on that WhatsApp messaging as quick as possible. I want to create that as our norm of communication. I want to go off email. I want to be able to message them, but hey, I just sent the CVs through to HR. I call it sometimes a meme test. So if I can send a meme to a client or candidate and it's not whack and like they're not like, why is she sending me a meme? And it's just so normal, I know the relationship's settled and that's good.
Okay, awesome. So, but you're doing this on desktop, right? Because it would be quite time-consuming.
It's laborious on the phone, yeah.
Yeah.
WhatsApp desktop always. And it's just another, like, I assume it's how people use Slack as I use WhatsApp.
Got it. Okay. I love this. This is so cool. You're doing a lot of different, interesting things to us. This is cool. So anything else on the marketing side of things that you're doing? By the way, you should totally have a podcast because you're coming across really well here on the on video. And so that to me is in terms of branding.
Maybe I should, yeah.
The ultimate.
I think I'd run out of things to say. I'm only really interested in financial.
No, because but you interview all the leaders, the same people are on panels with you, that like your clients, senior candidates, people like that who are experts.
Well, actually, that is something that I have done, but it wasn't a podcast, and it was a BD tool when we were a little bit quiet. As I started this thing called 20 Questions With, and I would message people that I wanted to work with and say, I'm doing this series on LinkedIn called 20 Questions With. I send them the questions, and then we have a video call, and we do it. And I'd publish it on LinkedIn. It was really good. And actually, it was, again, credibility by association. A lot of these people, it's the first time I was contacting, but they were I was posting their picture, and it looked like we'd known each other for years with the questions we were talking about. And so many people were like, oh, how do you know so-and-so? And I'm like, I don't. But, you know, and suddenly my senior credibility, like really into the upper echelons of like the bigger banks and the big banking, because these were the people I was targeting. They were like, oh, she knows so-and-so. And it was really quite invaluable.
Bingo. That's exactly what we're doing today, by the way. Credibility by association right here. So Jess Hamilton's credibility rubs off on me.
Yeah.
So awesome. Okay, I love it. Now, you mentioned you do BD every day. Could you talk a little bit about the rhythm and what are you trying to achieve on a daily basis in that regard?
So there's a few things. Like, it depends on how busy I am, right? So I still do the stuff that junior recruiters do. So I will still pull up a list of people who have interviewed with us this year and call through and make sure we're having a touch point. That to me is BD, because so BD for me, by the way, is not business, it's brand development. That's what I think. So what am I doing for my brand? So my brand is that I come back to people and I care about my candidates, because I do. And so that's one half of the thing, is the candidate work. So candidate calling, reaching out to prospective candidates. The BD stuff is the LinkedIn posting. It's the messaging. Do you want to go for a coffee? I sent two last night, and I've got two coffees booked in with two global heads today.
Like, wow, that's awesome.
So you've got to, it's got to be consistent, right? And it doesn't need to be time consuming. You don't need to. I've been in recruitment firms where you had to set aside a whole hour and you had to go through a list of people and pray to God that they answered the phone. And then you get busy and you don't do the hour. And then it goes into tomorrow. But I try and do micro wins through the day. So a few LinkedIn messaging here. I don't really give myself downtime. And it's not like I work like a maniac. Actually, if you talk to people that I used to work with, they would say she's a machine, but I don't work long hours. So I never work outside of my work hours. I just make them really productive.
So let me put a pin in that, because we want to circle back, because there's a whole nother chapter of this, which is, you know, balancing having your own business and being a mom, and how you put boundaries around your time. So let's go back to that.
Sure. That's the whole point, though, is that I don't, I don't scroll. Of course I bloody scroll, but I don't scroll as much as I probably could, because if I pick up my phone, I think, okay, I'm going to scroll and I'm going to send LinkedIn messages instead. And I try and aim for five a day, five LinkedIn messages. And typing it, hey, do you have time for a coffee next week, takes 2 minutes.
Okay. Love that. Second golden nugget from Jess Hamilton is BD, standing for brand development rather than business development. Yeah. That reframes the whole exercise. And that's super clever. It's a kind of more fun and more exciting way of thinking about it, rather than, because most people, BD is synonymous with cold calling, and they're like, ugh. I don't want to do that.
And you've got to sometimes be in the right frame of mind to do it. You know, if you're having a slow day and you're tired, you're not going to pick up the phone and be like, hey, but you can go on LinkedIn and very quickly send some messages. You can do calling. You should do calling, but it's not either or.
Yeah.
You can do both.
I read in the information you sent us that your North Star metric is referrals from clients and candidates. Could you, which I love this idea, by the way, and I don't know if I've come across any other recruiters where that is their number one metric. Could you elaborate on that?
How can you decide if you're the best if no one's referring you is what I've decided. So I've always been driven by the want to be the best in market, and not by billings, but the best where people go, do you know a recruiter? Yeah, go to Jess. That's it, it might be egotistic. Well, it is egotistical. It's, you know, like it's
no, I like it.
It's something in me that is the quality of the work that I produce and my knowledge of the sector that I recruit in is super important to me. And I think the only metric is referrals. Would you refer your friend to me? Do you think I'd be good for them? Would you refer someone you don't really know because it doesn't matter? And would you refer me jobs? And that is the holy grail, is getting referred jobs. Most consultancies that we work with will exclusively refer us jobs. So they'll go into a bank and they'll go and do, well, not exclusively referral jobs. I'm sure they do it to other agencies as well, but we still get a lot of work from them. So they will go into a bank and the bank will have some remediary action or some regulatory action and they need to hire some permanent stuff. Do you know anyone that does that? Oh yeah, Jess and Ian at Think Select. Go talk to them. Like, and that comes from the credibility. So the how we treat our candidates is how we treat our clients. We don't have a hierarchical system there. We don't think, you know, candidate is king is what I was taught at Robert Walters. And I think it stuck with me. So yeah, the referral metric, and we track it on our system, Bullhorn. So how did we find the candidate? You have to put in how you found it, LinkedIn, referral, jobs, the same, clients, the same. And then every year we assess.
I love that. And so that is a metric that you are tracking.
Totally.
In Bullhorn. So that's fantastic.
It's really important too for newer staff, like if you've got staff members and we're trying to get them, you know, we're quite evangelical about like this branding thing. And people think, oh, how do I know I'm doing it right? Like, I don't know. And then we can say, well, look, last month, most of your stuff was coming through referrals. It's working. Keep going.
There's a couple of strands to this that I wanted to explore. One is that you have partnered with key industry leaders in London. For example, you've mentioned consultancies a few times. How does that sort of referral partnership work?
So there's two main ones that we work with that we adore because of the way they treat, their whole ethos is just sort of in line with us. So we recruit for them, of course. And when they have those temp projects that I was talking about, they lean on us to help with the bench, as they call it. So they'll come, they don't want to maintain a bench of 100 fin crime people. So we can put those people in situ for them. And we just charge our normal fee and they put their fee on top. If they're referring work through to us, we have an agreement with them that we give them a percentage of it, but so far they've refused it. And instead we will co-host events with them like networking drinks and we'll foot the bill. So it's really generous of them. And it works for us.
Maybe they want the perception of they're not biased towards you. They're recommending because they genuinely
potentially
believe that you're the best, rather than if they were accepting a referral fee, then it might.
True.
Do you know what I mean? It gives does, the impression that that's the reason they're referring, and so they maybe.
Yeah, but I mean,
I can understand that.
They're really wonderful consultancies. Like when we first started, me and Ian, after the birth of my first son, they reached out the first week and were like, we want to support you guys. How can we do it? So they're just headed up by both of those firms have like family first policies. They're very kind. They're two of the best in the business. Like working, they're at like 150% capacity of work, whereas other consultancies aren't. Like it's just really beautiful to see.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, how did that relationship develop? Were they clients initially, or did you approach them specifically to try and work out some kind of referral relationship?
Again, lucky is the right word, but also blessed, I suppose. So the first one, I had some interactions with them when I used to be at Investigo. So they approached me and asked if I would do some sponsoring. It didn't work out because obviously I don't have control of the budget at Investigo. So that didn't work out. We just kept in touch. We went to a couple of their events just as attendees and thought they were amazing. And then the other one, they spun out of another consultancy that I used to work with and set up on their own a about the same time we did Think Select. So I think it was a little bit of underdogs helping underdogs.
Yeah, you were both starting a business at the same time.
Yeah, that makes sense. And they've just gone like, you wouldn't believe, they're phenomenal. Yeah.
Amazing. And so then, apart from these more like referral relationships where you serve the same customers, but with non-competing offerings, how else are you driving referrals on a day-to-day basis?
Oh, actually, it might be worth noticing on the consultancy. So Ian, my business partner, he runs our temp business and he feeds into a few other consultancies other than the two I've mentioned. And he gets them by meeting them. He just sends them LinkedIn messages and says, I admire the work you're doing. And a bit of industry knowledge is crucial there. Hey, I see that you're working with Danske Bank. I heard it's really tricky. I wonder if you'd have time for a coffee. You don't have to send that. Would you just have a time for a coffee? But his comes through credibility as well.
Yes. Okay. Love it. So you're approaching potential partners in the same ways you would approach a client, right?
Starting with 100 million percent. Yeah.
Okay.
We want them. We see the value. Like, even if it's they are talking about us in market, is beautiful. Like, these guys are going into our clients or potential clients when there's a real need for financial crime and regulatory compliance solutions. So initially, a bank will engage a consultancy to do an assessment, or they'll be mandated by the FCA overhead to have a skilled person. Then they may have a big requirement to hire temporary staff or permanent staff or whatever. Either way, these guys are in the muck and we want to be with them. Yeah,
definitely. And it's sort of a trigger or an indicator that if the bank is hiring consulting firms to help them in this area, is something they're really concentrating on, and they're probably going to also have hiring needs on the back of that.
And it's reciprocal though. So if we, because I know most of the heads in the banks now, so if I'm having a coffee with one and they say, oh my God, we're engaging consultancies, because I'm like, bing, and I message them and say, have you heard of this consultancy? And if they have, I introduce them. So they get the opportunity to pitch off the back of our knowledge as well. So it's not just a one-way street. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, fantastic. And then what else are you guys doing on a sort of day-to-day basis to drive referrals? Because I feel like this is a bit of a lost art. Obviously, before LinkedIn and before, you know, social media and everything else, this was the number one way that recruiters found candidates and clients, was by networking. But what is the verbiage? What are those conversations? What are the opportunities for that to happen?
So we don't have a referral scheme, and it's simply because it gets messy. I think any recruiter who's been doing their desk for a long time would agree. Once you've been in your market a long time, you know a lot of people, and so people tend to refer people you already know, and then it gets a bit like, where do I draw the line? So we just said no. It doesn't get messy. We obviously buy people gifts, if we make a placement off them and say thank you that way, but it's a bit different. I literally put at the end of, you know, when you're messaging someone on LinkedIn for a job, do you want to do this job? Actually, I could do a whole thing on how I send those messages, because I think I do a little bit different to other people, where I'll put the job title, the salary, and the job description and the company in that first LinkedIn messaging. There's no like, do you want a job at a bank? For me, there's a job going at Macquarie. Would you like it? It's the job description and here's the salary banding. And it's all part of our transparency ethos at Think Select. But in that message, I asked them, do you know anyone? If you're not interested, do you know anyone? And I'm sure it's not rocket science. I'm sure other people do that. But I ask everyone, once I have people interviewing, I say, oh, I've got other jobs in this space. Do you know anyone else that's looking? Always asking.
Just adding that question onto every conversation and every message, basically.
Yeah, people love referring people. People love to showcase that they know good people too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, and they usually do, to be honest. No one refers duds. Well, some of them do. But, you know, I just ask.
Just ask. Okay. All right. Fantastic. So what's awesome, though, is that you are actually tracking that as a source of jobs, as a source of candidates. And so you know how well that's working. And it reminds everyone to focus on it, because what you focus on is going to improve. That's one of the laws of, human psychology, right, is even without trying harder or applying new techniques and tactics, just by focusing on something and measuring it, it automatically is going to get better.
Yeah, absolutely. And how else do you know? Like, recruitment can be really sloggy, so you need to have some other thing other than your billings to know that you're on the right track.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, Jess, as we're sort of coming into the final segment of our time together, could you say a little bit more about the challenge of, being a working parent and coming back from maternity leave and trying to, you're launching a business at the same time. Often you must be excellent at time management, but can you say a little bit how you have navigated that?
I wouldn't say I'm excellent at time management because I'm not mamas, but I would say that I am really excellent at prioritizing and task focus. So I start my days with what is my non-negotiable? What do I need to get done today? And what can I call it my big list and my small list, and it's written down next to me always. So my big list is like sending short lists and, you need to do this. The small list is the stuff that could wait till the end of the week, but I make sure by Friday it's crossed off. And when I've got 5 minutes, I quickly do the small list. But honestly, I don't know if it's a really Kiwi thing or because I think English people are nuts. They work all hours. Like, I just don't do it. I outright don't do it. I don't answer my phone unless someone's at a final stage or there's a need, I'll answer my phone. But I've got a 3-year-old and an 18-month-old. So if someone calls me after hours, they're just going to like absolute chaos. There's no point me answering my phone because there's no conversation to have. I don't even log on to do shortlist searching when they go to bed.
Good for you.
No, it's so crucial to me that I have that separation because I've got a husband as well. I've not just got kids. Like, I need to see my husband. I need to, for me, to Pilates or something to really reset my mind. But I think for me, and it has always been the way, I've never worked late in recruitment. And my old bosses used to make fun of me for it because I'm out the door. But like, I had shit to do. Go ahead.
Okay, this is interesting. So, because I was kind of the same. In fact, my old boss, if I came in at 8:30 a.m., he'd be like, good afternoon, right? And then, and then if I left at 5 or 5:30, he'd be like, thanks for stopping by. It was that kind of culture back then.
Absolutely.
I think it's not quite like that now. But I was the top biller in my team, so he couldn't really, he was like,
I just like, so I think it came from, the proof was in the pudding for me, so kind of like what you're saying. So when I first arrived over here, it was 2013-14, and it was the be at your desk, on the, standing up to make phone calls, that kind of energy in recruitment, right?
Yep.
Remember those like?
Yeah.
But I was still one of the top billers, if not the top biller, and I always had stuff to do because I just arrived in the country and I was trying to make friends and I was constantly, I was traveling all the time. And so I just didn't have the time to sit at my desk after work. I didn't want to. And I thought, I don't really care. I don't really want to do recruitment forever. For me, it wasn't the be all and end all of what was going on in my life at the moment. I've never been super money motivated, I think. So that kind of played into it. But at the end of each year, I was like still top biller and I still wasn't working all these hours. And I thought, maybe I'll just keep doing this. And I've never really changed. There, of course, have been instances where I've worked late where there's a need.
Yes.
But I don't create the need. I don't work slower in my day, because I think, I find if you give yourself the excuse, it's kind of like if you know how you used the gym analogy before. I feel like if you say, I'll go to the gym today, you get to lunchtime and you haven't gone. So then you're like, I'll go tonight. And then you don't go tonight. I tell myself I'm doing this by 10 o'clock or I am, and it gets done.
So what are the boundaries, like start and finish time that are, that you adhere to?
8 o'clock if my husband's dropping the kids off. So 8:30 and then I finish at 5 o'clock. I just make sure. And I try and take one day off a month to spend with one of my kids one-on-one because they're still in like nursery. So we get some time together. And I don't, this is actually something interesting. So within my first 3 months of starting Think Select, I got pregnant with my second son by accident.
Wow. Okay.
Beautiful accident. And I had to call my business partner and say, Ian, and to top it off, in that first 3 months, my first son was Prem. And so he was at home with me a lot, really sick from nursery. You know how they get all the nursery bugs. So
yeah.
I'm like trying to recruit and I've got this screaming kid and all my clients are like, Jess, what are you doing? And I'm like, I don't know. Like it was all just like this beautiful chaotic mess. And then I had to call Ian and say, I'm pregnant again. And he said, how much time do you want to take off? And I said, there's a difference between what I want and what I can. Like we'd had a really successful first year. I think we'd done just close to a mil in that first year.
Amazing.
And I said, we came at, you know, that really busy recruitment year in 2022. So I said to Ian, what I want and what I can do is different. He said, why is it different? Like, he's just phenomenal. He's beautiful. And I said, well, I want to take 9 months because I did 9 months with my first. And he said, okay, go do 9 months. So I took 9 months off. And that was in the April, and we'd started the year before. And I took 9 months off, came back. And like, I think that really demonstrates my priorities. I just, work is work. And like, it is so far down my priority list if you're looking at my life that it, and I've created that priority list because it's my life and it's my responsibility as a business owner to decide what's important. And we've got someone in our team and she's got a young child. And I love that she sees me leading like that. I don't care if she works 9 to 5. I care that she gets the shortlist out, or I care that she does her BD. So task orientation versus time orientation is how you manage and own what you do. But yeah, I have to give the biggest shout out in the entire world to Ian Christie, my business partner,
All right.
Because he was just, I don't know. And then, and then I took a month off in the November before I left to go and get married in New Zealand. And he equally was like,
oh, wow.
I don't know, go. But this is what I mean, is that like, recruitment is important. All that's really important. But the billings will come. It's just money. It will come back. And if you really are good at your job and you really believe in yourself, you'll make it up. You'll be fine.
Awesome. That is a great way to finish, actually, I think, on that note. There's so much more I want to talk to you about. So let's think about doing a part two sometime in the future.
And I'd be up for that.
That would be awesome. Jess, this has been fantastic. Really, really enjoyed it. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me. I love talking about fin crime and recruitment.
Okay. Well, turns out I do as well. Thanks for watching. If you enjoyed this conversation, check out some of my other episodes. You'll see one or two suggested episodes on the screen now.